Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In a remarkable turn of events last week, the Washington State Department of Ecology denied a crucial permit for the world's largest methanol refinery proposed for Kalama, Washington. People in Kalama have been fighting this methanol refinery for 7 years, joined by activists across the region, who have written copious comments, testified at innumerable hearings, and rallied in Kalama and at the state capitol in Olympia. Today we talk with Cowlitz County activist Diane Dick and Kate Murphy, community organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper, about the next steps to finally put this methanol refinery out of its misery. Kate and Diane, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you for inviting me to this program.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We've been talking about this project, the world's largest methanol refinery proposed for Kalama, Washington, for several years on this show. There's been, as I noted at the beginning of the show, a major development in the last week, which really changes the trajectory of this project. So we're here today to continue a celebration. We started last week when we talked about Jordan Cove and the Kalama Methanol Refinery both being denied very important permits. Diane, you've been in this struggle for a really long time. I wanted to just get a sense from you how it feels to have the authorities and the regulatory body in Washington State finally supporting some of the things you've been saying for years.
It's been absolutely wonderful to get such broad support to oppose this project when we had very little recognition that there was even a problem with this project 7 years ago. It was 7 years ago this month that we actually received notice that this project was being contemplated in the community when the Port of Kalama held a presentation from Northwest Innovation Works presenting this project. And a week later, they presented it to Port Westward at Clatskanie. I think in the last 2 years, what has really developed is the critical importance of greenhouse gases and how they affect the global environment. 7 years ago, that was not the case. But in the last couple of years, we've realized that this is of critical importance, and large gas projects like NWIW contribute huge amounts of greenhouse gases. So that has been a real change factor, I think, in setting back this project. Hopefully it's demise, actually. I would like to think that it is not going to go forward.
And NWIW stands for Northwest Innovation Works, which is basically a Chinese-connected company that came out of nowhere, it seems, to suddenly be proposing these methanol refineries several years ago in Kalama, Port Westward, and also in Tacoma. Even though they'd already proposed it in Kalama, Tacoma was where their first actual energy was really getting going. And it inspired a huge opposition that was, I think, very unusual for Tacoma. Like, suddenly there was this huge environmental movement in Tacoma to shut down that methanol refinery. And they succeeded really quickly. Why do you think, Diane, that when they shifted their focus to Kalama, that there wasn't the same kind of organized opposition that Tacoma had been able to engender?
There are a couple of reasons. I think one is because of the population in Tacoma is huge. And so you had a large number of people who were able to coordinate and organize and research the issues involved with that project in Tacoma. In Tacoma, that project would have used a large amount of water that Tacoma residents needed. So I think what first raised a red flag for the people of Tacoma was the use of their utilities. This was not the case in Kalama. It's a town of only about 2,000 people, and we are on the Columbia River. And it presented the ability to draw large amounts of water from the Columbia River without impacting the local residents. So the impacts to local residents were not as problematic, I think, when this project was first proposed.
Also, it seems to me that being such a small town, it might have been harder to put together a critical mass like they had in Tacoma.
Absolutely. The only environmentalists at the time were more located in the community of Longview and in the Vancouver-Portland area. And another reason this did not gather a lot of attention at the time is that we were fighting multiple other large projects, including the West Coast's largest coal terminal at that time proposed at Longview. And within the year, there were a couple other projects proposed at the Port of Longview. There was also the issues of moving oil from production fields in the Midwest by rail to West Coast terminals. And this was happening both to California and to projects proposed in the Pacific Northwest. And it was already recognized that these were huge impacts to both the terminal locations and to communities along the rail lines. We are also aware of the rail line impacts because coal was also being proposed for new terminals on the Pacific West Coast, also involving the rail lines.
Well, Kate, Columbia Riverkeeper got involved pretty early on. Well, they'd already been up in Cowlitz County, which is where Longview and Kalama are located, fighting the massive coal terminal that Diane was just talking about. But how did Columbia Riverkeeper get involved in fighting the methanol refinery?
Yeah, so that was a little bit before my time at Riverkeeper. And Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey, who worked there, I believe the story is that someone came in and spoke to her and said, you know, what's going on with this methanol refinery? And why aren't we fighting it? And I want to fight this methanol refinery. And so Jasmine, you know, looked into it and did some amazing work in Cowlitz County, really informing community members about what was happening, notifying folks along the pipeline route, the Kalama Lateral Pipeline, that their properties were being considered for a pipeline route, and really kind of just starting with educating community members and inviting them to learn more about the project, and then basically asking them, like, is this a priority for you? Do you want us to join you and fight this project? And it was a pretty resounding yes. And so we just kind of went from there. I actually got to be a little bit involved in the resistance of this project before I was officially working with Columbia Riverkeeper. My mom and I were kind of involved in the environmental movement together and, you know, met some of these folks actually just when I was kayaking on the Kalama River at one of the rallies at Camp Kalama. So, you know, it's really wonderful to be able to be a part of this work in this capacity and work so closely with the community members in Kalama and Cowlitz County on organizing to fight this project.
Well, one of the things that struck me about Columbia Riverkeeper is that they are connected with a really savvy bunch of lawyers. And it wasn't just Columbia Riverkeeper, but also, I guess, the Center for Biological Diversity got involved with lawsuits. And there were numerous lawsuits. We don't have to go into it all today because we've been talking about this for the last few years. But it seemed that there were several points that the lawsuits made that were then just completely ignored when the environmental impact statements were put out by Northwest Innovation Works and Cowlitz County, who was basically the overseer for the project. So I wanted to get a sense from you what it felt like to see the final second supplemental environmental impact statement be denied approval by the Department of Ecology. And the point is that the Department of Ecology used to deny the permit. Was there any kind of deja vu?
I came from an activist background, so I was seeing a kind of movement that I hadn't really seen previously. And yes, we definitely have an amazing legal team at Columbia Riverkeeper and lots of great legal support. Our outside counsel for our federal lawsuit with Earth Justice, and they do amazing work as well. And we had other partner organizations on some of those lawsuits, as well as, you know, Sierra Club, Washington Environmental Council, you mentioned Center for Biological Diversity, and Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. And yeah, it's been really amazing to see this denial come through. But what really stands out to me is, you know, we couldn't have these legal arguments and Earth Justice representing us without the level of community support that has happened. And so seeing the final document come out and seeing these little tweaks in language that really resonated with the comments that the community had put forward, you know, to be able to move a state agency at that point in the process to alter any language is really a testament to the diligent research that the community members provided and the excellent testimony that folks offered. I mean, we had massive amounts of testimony. You know, initially there was public hearings. You know, we had over 1,000 people show up to a public hearing, but then we had these virtual hearings that people had to attend in the midst of, you know, the wildfires and this global pandemic. And we had over 12 hours of testimony that people gave, and, you know, roughly 5 out of 7 of those were in opposition to this project. We had thousands and thousands of comments submitted to the Department of Ecology with really high rate of opposition, like overwhelming public opposition happening for this project. And it's really impressive. And it's something else that is worth noting, which is unusual about this particular project, is that after the close of the comment period for this final environmental impact statement, we received almost 7,000 additional comments in opposition to this project after the close of the comment period. So, which we passed on to Governor Inslee and the Department of Ecology, because we felt it was important that they know that the community was continuing to give input and continuing to show interest in protecting the area that they love from these harmful developments.
Well, I want to go back about 4 years ago to the first meeting that I attended about the Klamath Methanol Refinery, and it was for the shoreline permit. And it was very surprising to me, because I've been going to all these hearings around the Orbi train terminal that was being proposed for Vancouver, where there'd be huge outpourings of opposition and really good science being presented and lots of elected officials who were opposed to the project. But at this meeting for the Klamath Methanol Refinery, all the elected officials, county commissioners, and I guess some of the city council people were all really excitedly supportive of this methanol refinery. And the whole hearing seemed to be a dog and pony show for Northwest Innovation Works. And it made me really think this is going to be a really hard thing to fight, because I realize this is a very different environment than Vancouver, Washington, just a few miles south of Klamath. I want to talk about the dynamics that shifted in the 4 years since that hearing. And interestingly, it's the shoreline permit that we're still talking about now that was just denied. So what happened in that time to change the conversation and to basically put to rest the arguments that kept coming up in each of these environmental impact statements about how this was actually going to be a net reduction in greenhouse gases for the world and for Washington State if this methanol refinery were built?
There has been a sea change in how these projects are being viewed. When you talk about that shoreline permit, that was in early 2016, I believe it was March. And a couple of months before then, there was also an air discharge permit that also drew a large crowd. It was a year before that we had the first large public hearing in Klamath at the high school that looked at the actual first draft environmental impact statement. So by this time, a reason I think you saw that dog and pony show was because the local officials finally realized that we were serious, that we could gather a crowd. We could gather a crowd from Portland to Seattle to come to these hearings and provide comments. So they were getting their act together at that point to provide a show of opposition, which they continue to do. What changed between that and this last opinion is that we convinced Governor Inslee that he should not be supporting this project based on environmental impacts, and specifically climate change and the greenhouse gas issues. That was huge. So that and the importance of the greenhouse gas issues and the use of current state regulation to control greenhouse gases became more politically important, I would say. The decision by Department of Ecology to completely deny this conditional use permit on the Shorelines Act was surprising, because we know there was a lot of political pressure involved in this decision. The reason Department of Ecology was having to review this and make an opinion was because the State Shorelines Board had previously reviewed the Department of Ecology decision to approve a permit, and that was challenged, and they sent it back to Department of Ecology to review it for inadequate study on the greenhouse gas issue. So we are extremely gratified to see that Department of Ecology saw through the bogus arguments that speculating on future economic methanol markets would somehow reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is an important argument for the use of science and factual science and what the real numbers show. That's been wonderful because these economic market arguments have been used in other projects. They tried to use them in the coal terminal project, and I believe they also tried to use them in the Tacoma LNG project. So to shoot down these bogus claims that there is going to be greenhouse gas reductions by producing more greenhouse gases because future global markets will sort it all out is extremely gratifying.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Cowlitz County activist Diane Dick and Kate Murphy, community organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper, about the next steps to finally put the Kalama Methanol Refinery out of its misery. Well, let's talk about what happens next, because this was really big news. I got an email from you the other day, Diane, which said, well, it's not over yet, but you think it really is. So first of all, I want to get your sense, Kate, because your organization has been so involved in all this litigation. What happens next legally?
With the shorelines permit at the state level, the Northwest Innovation Works does have 21 days to appeal Department of Ecology's decision to deny the shorelines permit. So the decision was made on January 19th. I think that puts the deadline around February 9th for them to appeal. And we are not sure how that's going to go, but we are definitely expecting appeals, and we are prepared. Our legal team is prepared to continue forward with this process until we're sure that this refinery is not going to be built in Kalama on the banks of the Columbia River. So we are anticipating whatever they might do, and we're just going to continue forward. We really feel like these last two victories between the federal case and the state agency recognizing that the greenhouse gas emissions are so impactful and contrary to our Washington state and our region's climate goals. As Diane mentioned earlier, that those things aren't going to change. The fact that we have some new legislation in place in Washington that is more protective and calls for bigger cuts in a quicker time frame, and the fact that we know how many greenhouse gas emissions this project would produce, those things are still going to be true. So to appeal this decision, I think we have a pretty strong case in defense of protecting this area from this project.
Well, one of the things that struck me when I was reading the Department of Ecology's decision to deny the permit was it went bullet point by bullet point. These are all the issues that Columbia Riverkeeper has been raising for the last several years, ranging from the way that the original EIS and subsequent EISs basically really diminished the actual greenhouse gas impacts of this project. But one of the things that also struck me was pointing out that this project would make it impossible for Washington to meet its new goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions under new laws that were passed. So I just wonder, what was your sense? I want to get this from both of you, of seeing every single point, every single argument you've been making for the last umpteen years be vindicated by Department of Ecology's decision.
I just want to start by saying, like, for me, that felt like a real recognition that they were listening to the public. I felt that folks who participated in this process gave such high-level testimony that was very science-based and provided a lot of thorough research for ecology to look at. And so for them to be able to recognize that the public was so opposed to this project, but also really taking into account a lot of that citizen science that came forward, this group has been particularly vigilant and quite skilled in analyzing the numbers and really assessing a lot of the upstream and downstream impacts and things like that. And I think, you know, this is an indication of what we see on a larger regional scale over the last, you know, 15, 20 years in this area of the Pacific Northwest, where we have essentially defeated every major fossil fuel infrastructure proposal on the Columbia River, whether it's coal, oil, or fracked gas. And that has a lot to do with the larger overall awareness of the climate crisis we're in and how these projects disproportionately affect BIPOC communities and low-income communities. It also has a lot to do with the increased collaboration that's going on with these different community groups who are trying to protect the areas and that they love and the communities that live there. And, you know, when I first started this work, my mom and I got more involved in the activist scene, you know, around 2013 with the Keystone stuff. And the work felt a lot more siloed then. And you didn't see these the same kind of collaborative work going on that's happening now. There's these coalitions blooming that are powerful, and they're coordinating and they're sharing the burden of like having to fight these projects, that have, you know, these massive resources behind them. And it's just so inspiring to see what is possible, the power of community members coming together. And you know, I think this creates a great space as we move forward for us to hopefully be able to start developing some more protective, preventative solutions for the situation we're in, versus always having to be, you know, playing defense and kind of saying, oh, no, we got to stop this new project from happening. But it's just really so inspiring to see that the community can come together in this way that's so powerful, and also that, you know, not only on the local level, but state and federal levels, we're starting to get some ears. I think for a while we really got focused on local level stuff, which was really important in the last few years to focus locally. And I think it's still important. But, you know, we've had some great city policies passed that are protective of communities and fossil fuel development in the areas. So I think it's just a great sign of the trend that we are moving away from fossil fuels, as science shows us that we should.
And as Joe Biden says we should do as well. I'm wondering what impact you think that the Trump administration, the last four miserable years that we've been living through, has had on actually helping to define and inspire and grow the movement that you're just talking about.
I think that the Trump administration, for a lot of the environmental community and environmental activists, was probably not as much of a setback to their programs as perhaps other types of groups experienced. And that is because environmental organizations have been fighting for their programs for so long that they saw setbacks with the Bush administration. There may not have been as much as they hoped to accomplish with the Obama administration. And so they were already experienced in how to handle the setbacks that the Trump administration presented. I think the biggest problem we have had with the Trump administration is the institutional knowledge in some of these agencies that have been trying to do their work in spite of what the executive branch has asked them to do. When you're talking about the Environmental Protection Agency and some of the other work that has been done to try and protect the environment, and the way that the Trump administration had demoralized the administrators on down and have lost a lot of that institutional expertise, I think it is most troubling. So I think that's an area where there is going to need to be rebuilding. I think the environmental organizations have done an excellent job of keeping track where all of the setbacks have occurred in order to mitigate going forward the damage that has been done in the last 4 years.
Well, back in, I think it was October of 2016, I was sitting around having dinner with a bunch of friends, and one of them suddenly blurted out, "What are you going to do if Trump is elected president?" And it was kind of like, at that point, I was still not really wanting to even vocalize that possibility. But I blurted out, "Well, I'm going to work locally." And interestingly, we had that opportunity to watch that, because right after Trump was elected was when the Portland City Council finalized the ban of any future fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland. And I remember that very moving and very sad and very amazing day. And I wonder if you felt that there was a motivation to really dig in and work locally all the time that we've been dealing with Trump as sort of somehow being the president of the United States.
I wholly agree. My mother-in-law, who passed 20-some years ago, presented me with a little button that I still have that said, "Think globally, act locally." And I took that to heart 4 years ago, that you can only really make a lot of significant change in your local area. And if everybody took care of their local area, we would not have the global problems that we have now. When the Trump administration came in, we were already acting locally because we had these projects that we had been working locally on since before 2010. So the community locally was already primed to fight these projects. They had already learned some tools, thanks to Columbia Riverkeeper, by the way, on how to organize and how to provide substantive comments, how to provide that scientific information that agencies like the Department of Ecology need in order to justify their decisions. And that is what we provided to Department of Ecology, both for this project and for other projects that were defeated locally. Yeah, I agree that, yes, we do need to focus locally. I think Vancouver and Portland have done wonderful things politically to strengthen the regulations there against fossil fuel projects. I don't know that that's going to happen here locally at that level, but we have certainly put the local officials on notice that these projects will not slip by unnoticed. We have let speculators know if they're looking for an easy community to slip one of these dirty projects in, this might not be a good place. So those are all issues that I think you can work on locally. And I am grateful for the larger environmental organizations that are working on national levels and global levels to coordinate this work.
How about you, Kate? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that on, here in Portland, I remember being at those Portland City Council hearings with the city's lead little banners that everyone was holding. And I think that the sentiment was strong then that we understood the importance of working at a local level. And especially when we had an administration come in that was really determined to push forward a lot of environmental rollbacks, we knew that in the meantime, having that local work in place was going to be really foundational. And I think, for a lot of folks who were already aware of what was going on but weren't sure how to engage, I think, honestly, this kind of aggressive approach and lack of regard for thoughtfully placed environmental protections did inspire a lot of folks to get involved and just reach out and say, what can I do? I mean, I've talked to, as a community organizer, I've talked to a lot of folks who say, I've never been involved in something like this before, but I just felt compelled. I felt like we had to be involved and this is affecting the community that I care about. And so I think, having those massive rollbacks happen really pushed people forward to say, well, we have to do what we can to be protective of our communities. And I think it's just really inspiring. And what Diane mentioned about, building up these tools and resources over time through these different experiences, that is a really amazing thing that's come out of this movement, is now we have this huge toolbox, essentially, of ways to organize. And what's beautiful about our toolbox is that there's no dark underbelly. I mean, there's no secrets to expose, like selling liquid sunshine that, instead of using your product for plastics. And I think that that's really beautiful because it's really about coming together and working collaboratively and then sharing the workload. And it's really effective and it's protective, and I find it so inspiring.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFT LP FM and KODX LP FM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Cowlitz County activist Diane Dick and Kate Murphy, community organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper, about the next steps to finally put the Kalama Methanol Refinery out of its misery. Well, now that Joe Biden is president, and he's been making a big point all week about how his administration is going to be science-based, I wonder how you feel this may turn the tide on the kind of work that you've both been doing for so many years.
Oh, well, I find that extremely refreshing. I have a background in public health, and so it's a relief to see that we have leadership that is prioritizing evidence-based decisions and putting folks in charge who are experienced in those areas. I think that applies across the board. And, you know, of course, all of these fossil fuel infrastructure projects are a huge threat to public health. But in the larger picture, I feel extremely relieved that we can rely on science. And I think, you know, for the most part, that's what a lot of us have been doing all along. But, you know, we've been running into some obstacles with certain leadership. And so I think it's helpful to know that that's not going to be as much of an obstacle. But I think we have so much work to do. We aren't to remove some of the aggressive rollbacks is great, but we really have so much catching up to do. We're very behind in terms of responding to the climate crisis. And what we really need to do is to be able to use this momentum to focus on projects that actually build resilience for our communities, because we are going to be continuing to face the effects of the changing climate and the effects of that has, like, this you know, different things like pandemics, like, that will continue to affect us in different ways as the climate changes and creates different habitats for viruses and pathogens and things like that. So really working toward effective, you know, long-term solutions that are more sustainable and resilient, and looking at a just transition. I mean, we've got to recognize the indigenous leadership that has happened since time immemorial and is true with all these projects that we're talking about today. And I think, you know, we are fortunate enough to have their wisdom that they share with us about ways to care for this land that are more sustainable. And I think that we need to put more of our focus on things like that and having a just transition away from these harmful projects that are largely just about corporate profits at this point.
Well, despite the fact that we have a new president who seems to agree with us about a lot more than the last president did, I have concerns because I see that the response to the openness and to science and the concerns about true sustainability on the part of the Biden administration are maybe really welcomed in a place like Portland or Seattle. But I see actually in both Tacoma and in Cowlitz County that there's still a lot of resistance. In Tacoma, it's a little bit subtler because there's a lot of Democrats who are really in bed with the fossil fuel industry. And I know from my friends up there that the struggle continues. And it's certainly a very gnarly situation compared to dealing with even Vancouver, Washington, which we could talk a little bit about how that's transformed in the last 6 or 7 years because of the fossil fuel fight. But I'm particularly concerned about Cowlitz County. I keep having this image. I was going up to visit the Keeleys, Sally Keeley and Company, at the end of the summer. And as I was turning onto their road, I saw this giant Trump sign, which I was told by Sally's daughter, Cam, that it lit up at night. And I'm not sure if it's still up there, but it really gave me a sense as I was turning up their road that they are not exactly in the same kind of company as I am living in Portland and having Biden signs all over. And I'm wondering, Diane, what you feel are the continuing challenges of getting people in Cowlitz County to appreciate that it's a good thing that the methanol refinery is probably not going to be built, and that they need to really rethink their relationship to jobs and industry and to the environment and basically to their general outlook in general.
You're right that areas of the state like Cowlitz County and perhaps more industrialized areas of the state are going to grapple with the issue of how we address climate change and the impacts from that a little bit more, because they continue to view industrialization as tied into the fossil fuel industry. And I think we're going to have to do more education on how we can transition economic development away from ties to oil and gas to renewable energies and sustainable types of industry. Right now, I don't think some people understand or have a good picture of that. And I think we need to do a better job of visualizing that future for them that contains economic development and that three-letter word job, which is the issue of jobs is critical both in Calhous County, which has had a longstanding higher unemployment rate than the rest of the state. And I know in the Tacoma area where they have are dependent on a lot of industrialization. And they don't view economic development as encompassing those environmental goals that we have. It's a different vision of how one pursues a living. And this, I think, is something that we need to continue to work on. I think we've done a little bit better lately in tying some of these environmental issues to both social and economic injustice. I think it's important that we continue that because there has not been a good recognition, or there's a growing recognition that a lot of the economic injustice has been dependent on the profits of the fossil fuel industry. If it weren't for allowing degradation of low-income communities and communities of color, these industries would not have flourished. And so we need to provide a better vision of the future that involves sustainable industry and how we can bring people with a different perspective into that vision of the future. I think this is going to be difficult. I think we're looking at issues that deal with the heart of capitalism when we're talking about environmental sustainability. I mean, capitalism is based on increasing growth of populations, of consumption, and we know that increasing populations and consumptions are things that we need to tackle in order to bring down our overuse of our environmental resources. We are already beyond the capacity of the earth to sustain the current population. And in order to get a handle on that, we're going to have to rethink our economic theories and the way we go about providing a living for people. We have quality of life issues, but at the very basis, we have to provide them how to make a living. And those are issues that I think we need to tackle in tandem with addressing environmental degradations and how we mitigate that.
Well, another issue that seems to be prevalent, I'm sure everywhere, but we've noticed it a lot in Washington State, is that there's a lot of conflict of interest with elected political officials and some of these fossil fuel corporations. In particular, there's this guy, Richard DeBolt, who seemed to both be, I think, was he a state representative and also worked for Northwest Innovation Works. I was wondering if people like DeBolt and Gary Locke, who used to be the governor of Washington, who was really a big backer of and really help engineer the whole plan to get NWIW to build the methanol refineries in Washington. Do you see that's still a threat, that kind of nepotism, let's say, between industry and elected officials is going on unabated in Washington? And it's also obviously happening in Oregon as well.
I think self-interest is always a problem when you're talking about politics and money. Whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans or your local independents, if the people involved in your governance are only interested in what they're going to get out of it, and if you have companies that are only interested in how they're going to make a profit, these people are going to meet up and find a way to promote their agendas. This is a vigilance we have to maintain, and something we have had to maintain since the beginning of this country. So that I don't think is going to go away. I think we need to scrutinize people more who are running for office and making sure that they have the best interests of the community in their programs. Yes, it has to be an education of the electorate. And thanks to you, Barbara, I'm hoping the media will be scrutinizing potential candidates even more than they have in the past. So that's one way to combat it. I am disappointed that sometimes our local news media has been bought out by business interests, and that has been one problem in our local area. where there's been bias shown by local media, and there's been a diminishment of local media as it's been brought out by larger corporations. So this is another issue I think that we have to address at some point.
Well, one of the disappointing things to me about the last election was that Marilyn Strickland, who was once the mayor of Tacoma, just as they were courting Northwest Innovation Works, and she was a very key person in courting Northwest Innovation Works to build the methanol refinery at first in Tacoma. She's been elected to, I don't remember which House district in Washington State, to serve in the U.S. Congress, and ran against a very pro-environmental, very person who really understands the dangers of fracking and the dangers of fossil fuel. And I don't remember how much she beat her by, but it was substantial. She had a really big machine that helped to get her elected. And I know that environmentalists around the state were really working to try to not get her elected. She's an African-American woman, and I think a lot of ways people saw her electing her was this was a good progressive voice to have and not really looking at her background. So I wonder, how do we prevent more Marilyn Stricklands from getting elected to higher office around the state of Washington and Oregon?
I think we have to look at our election laws. We have to look at dark money in political action campaigns. There simply has to be a better regulation so we have more transparency in knowing where money is coming from and where it's going. This, of course, plays out at the national level also, but it's also at the local level. We don't know where a lot of the money from Northwest Innovation Works or their parent corporation, Pan Pacific Energy, has gone. They're private. They don't have to say who they've given money to, and how corrupt local politicians are is a problem. How do we find that out? Especially if we don't have local media willing to do investigative research in the multitude of local officials that are out there. So I find it interesting that we let our local news media know that Pan Pacific Energy had taken money for COVID relief as far as the Paycheck Protection Program. And there to date has been no revelations in our local news media about that, even though it's dubious how a corporation that has produced nothing in the last 7 years could be impacted by the pandemic. I mean, that, why isn't something as basic as that being revealed by our local people? I mean, we have a lot to work on in the future to rectify misinformation and deliberate deception.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFD LPFM and KODI XLP FM, KMUN and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Cowlitz County activist Diane Dick and Kate Murphy, community organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper, about the impending demise of the Klamath Methanol Refinery. For the last part of the show, I kind of wanted to do some shout-outs to some of the people that have really done some important work. And the first person I wanted to bring up was somebody that Kate mentioned because she's kind of filled her shoes, and that's Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey. So, Kate, let's talk a little bit about what Jasmine did and how that has helped you to fill the role that you're filling right now.
I'm pretty lucky coming into this in the position that I did. I had some very big shoes to fill, of course. Jasmine did an amazing job not only organizing folks in the local community, but really empowering them to take this on themselves. She did a great job helping build trust with folks and letting them know that we were there to support this fight and to facilitate them doing it the way that they wanted to. And I think that that's really important when we're going into other communities to do work, that we really listen to the needs of the community members and put their voices forward first. So Jasmine did a great job of that, and just really, you know, the grit of just kind of, you know, sending out letters to looking at a map and where she thought the pipeline route was going to go and sending out letters to folks and see if she could get a bite and see if there was any interest. I think, you know, just that determination to inform and to support is so critical when we're working in community. And Jasmine, you know, I can't really sum up the magnitude of her work that she did with her years at Riverkeeper. I mean, she just an amazing organizer and for the first quite a while, I was being called the new Jasmine. And so it's nice to now be called Kate, because I think like I've settled in, but it was a big honor to be able to be trusted to come in and try to pick up the work that Jasmine had been doing, and feel very grateful that folks have shown me trust and allowed me into this very private fight in their communities. And so, yeah, I owe a lot to Jasmine. I've learned a lot from watching her work before I got to Riverkeeper. And also just, I get to continue to collaborate with Jasmine, with her work in Columbia County as well. And so, yeah, I'm just very, I have a lot of gratitude for my predecessor and the foundation that she laid with her organizing.
Actually, I remember that Jasmine was really the person who kicked off the campaign against the Pembina liquid propane terminal that was proposed for Portland. That's when I first got to know her. And it was amazing to watch her grow from that. I mean, I learned more about what she did actually from Dan Sears. It was really her vision. And I think she did the same thing, it seems, in Kalama with the methanol refinery. She understood it, and then she took it on and really brought Columbia Riverkeeper into the picture. Two of the things that I was really respectful of Jasmine and her organizing is she always made sure there was food available and childcare. And I'm not sure if, Diane, if you're the one who told me this story about how she pulled out a megaphone from her car once and somebody asked her, where'd you get that megaphone? My mother gave it to me when I was 18. So I think that she kind of, you know, had an activist upbringing as well.
Oh, that's true. And Kate, you have had large shoes to fill and you have done a wonderful job of it. Jasmine was critical in educating and engaging the Kalama community in understanding what was trying to come into their midst. I first met Jasmine in 2012 when she and Dan Sears were in the community organizing on the Millennium Bulk Terminals coal terminal. And that's where I first got to know both Jasmine and Dan Sears. I'd like to give a big shout out to Dan Sears. He was there from the beginning, especially when we were trying to understand natural fracked gas issues. He was involved in Jordan Cove. He was there with the Warrington LNG plant and the Associated Washington Expansion Pipeline. So some of the opposition that we had for the Kalama methanol refinery predated that project, because gas pipelines had already been proposed and defeated in Cowlitz County, both with the Bradwood Landing and the expansion of the Williams Northwest Pipeline with the Washington Expansion Pipeline Program. So I got to know a little bit about gas pipelines early on because of Dan's interest and Columbia Riverkeeper's current and prior involvement in gas pipeline issues. I think that was really critical in how they understood the magnitude of the impact from the Kalama methanol refinery. They were the first to understand how large this refinery would be and on the impact it would have for the rest of the state. And I think that was supremely important in bringing in other organizations to oppose it. It was because of their credibility and their prior achievement, it was why Earth Justice was convinced to take on this case. Craig Law Center has also been important in opposing these projects. So we have had wonderful support from these nonprofit legal organizations that have supported our efforts to oppose these projects. We can do a lot at the local level, but a lot of times these projects are defeated when we start pushing the legislation that we have in place that should be defeating these projects from the outset. And sometimes it gets dragged on through the courts. And it's important to have that legal representation. And we are fortunate that we have provided the credibility to bring in these organizations to help us.
So, Kate, what is in the near future now in terms of the appeals? Do you have any sense of a timeline of when NWIW might appeal and what would happen after that?
Well, like I said, they have 21 days to appeal from the point of the decision on the 19th. So we're keeping a close eye on any action between now and February 9th on the state decision. And of course, if they do appeal, we will be pursuing the project and defending a college's decision to deny the shorelines permit. We feel we have a really strong argument to support that decision.
I just wonder how long this could all drag on.
Well, you know, on the federal level, we had a victory with that federal court case with the Army Corps of Engineers, and they were ordered to do a new environmental impact statement for the project, which includes the Klamath Lateral Pipeline. And that process would take at least a year. And in the meantime, all of their federal construction permits have been revoked until that new EIS is in place. So it could continue on for, you know, they could appeal that decision and it could continue on for another year plus. And once we, you know, if they went through that EIS process and then we decided to continue forward with the next steps of assessment. But we're pretty confident that, well, we're hopeful anyway, that they'll kind of see the forest through the trees here and understand that this project is really not going to be successful at all.
Well, I was talking with Eric DePlace last week, and I asked him what he thought should be the future of these companies. He said he thinks that they should start filing bankruptcy.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
And go the way of Oregon LNG, which filed bankruptcy. Well, they pulled out of Astoria. Now it's going to be 5 years this April.
And the same for Millennium Bulk Terminals.
Oh, right. And we should just mention before we go that they're gone, right?
They still have active legal cases, but there's nothing left of them at this point.
And they lost their only buyer, right? I mean, they've got no financial incentive to go on.
Correct.
Well, it's good to talk with you guys. It's really, Kate, you want to say one more thing?
Yeah, I just wanted to say one more quick thing in terms of acknowledgements. I just want to acknowledge Seth Gernes from Sierra Club, who was another amazing organizer who was working on this campaign before I joined Columbia Riverkeeper. And that they are someone I've learned a lot from, and they have put a lot of energy and resources into this campaign, including, you know, the organizing of No Methanol Mondays, which has been a regular deal, but used to be in person. We would drive up, you know, before dark, we'd head up to Lacey and line the streets outside the Department of Ecology's offices with signs, encouraging them to do the right thing. And, you know, that's all switched to virtual actions, which have continued to be really, really great in terms of people participating. But just wanted to make sure that Seth was acknowledged as well. There's so many people. I mean, there's amazing folks in Kalama that we could talk about for a long time, too. Just all the research and everything. And yeah, just huge appreciation for all the folks who have been a part of this.
I would also like to thank Sierra Club and Sep Gernes for her support of this. I don't want to leave out the Oregon and Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, who are especially important in pointing out the health hazards and providing a lot of the scientific data that has been involved in the work. There are just numerous people and individuals who have contributed to this victory, and I thank all of them from the bottom of my heart.
And I want to thank both of you guys for all the work that you've been doing. And I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having us, Barbara.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you, Barbara.
We've been talking with Cowlitz County activist Diane Dick and Kate Murphy, community organizer with Columbia Riverkeeper. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCPB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO, or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll continue our celebration of the demise of Jordan Cove LNG when we talk with Ali Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate, Stacey McLaughlin, a landowner in Douglas County impacted by the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline, and Klamath Modoc visual artist Kaila Farrell-Smith. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Sin nakir mas to dato tino mato kuna.